Good evening. This is the 13th of the Derech Hashem series. Unfortunately, it did not get recorded live on the phone, but I was able to record it on my digital recorder. So now I'm going to play it on the computer so that it will be recorded and be there as a conference call. So I'm sorry that you won't be able to hear the questions, but you will be able to hear the answers, and hopefully next week it'll be working properly.
So tonight's
the
very sixth. Yud Dalet Shvat, and this is the 13th class of Derech Hashem. So tonight we're starting with section 1, chapter 5, paragraph 4. And we left off last time talking about the concept of the marionette and what that looks like and how the energy goes from top to bottom. But before we go into that again, which I might just review that mashal, I want to take some time to set the stage a little bit more, because I realize I think at this point we need to, and then also the four tiered world. So we're going to go a little bit Kabbalistic here. We have the, not that the book isn't, but whatever. He does discuss these four worlds a little bit later, but we're going to go through them a little now, and also the concept of the spirit. So we understand that this world, called Olam, comes from the root Elam, He'elam, hidden, that this world is hidden. So what's hidden here? Hashem. And Hashem has to be hidden. Hashem and Hashem's direct influence and Hashem's direct will has to be hidden so that we can have space for free will. So we talked about how Hashem had to create space, so to speak, within Hashem's self in order for the world to exist physically. And that's not something that I can really understand. But there is that concept of tzimtzum, that Hashem had to contract Hashem's self in order to create space for the world to exist, which is why one reason why we call Hashem Hamakom, because Hashem is the place, Hamakom, that everything exists inside. So that's physical. But then spiritually also, or in terms of will, Hashem had to contract his ratzon in order to give us space for our own ratzon to exist. So, and we've also talked about angels and forces, malachim and kochot, and how those function just a little bit. But we need to just give it a bigger framework before we continue, I think. So with Hashem's contraction, the Kabbalists say, and this is not in this particular book, but the Kabbalists say that Hashem contracted and then he spun a thread of light. And from that thread of light, there emanated 10 spherot. And it's through those spherot. Pardon? Okay, that's exactly what we're going to do right now. So 10 spherot emanated, and it's through that that the world was created. So let's say, what are the spherot? So first of all, the word sphera means the same thing as in English, sphere. Right, so it means an orbit or a circular thing or an environment, all those things. It's related to the word sapphire, sapir, sefer, book, mispar, number, misparayim, scissors. Right, so it's all about the root samach pe resh is about delineation. Right, so if you think about a story, it has a beginning, middle, and end, something doesn't belong in the story. It delineates. The story delineates. A sefer delineates. A mispar counts something and something else isn't included in it. Misparayim trim things, so you're cutting one thing from another. So a sefer, the concept of it is something that delineates one from another. So basically, my muscle for trying to understand how the spherot work or what they are, so we have names for them that I'm sure you're familiar with hearing. So the first, the top three, they're usually divided into the top three and the lower seven. So the top three are either Chachma, Bina, and Dat, or Keter, Bina, and Dat, I think. And then the lower seven, the top three switch around their names depending on if you want Chachma, Bina, and Dat, or if you put Keter on the top. But the lower seven always have the same names, and that's Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and Malchut. The lower seven relate to the seven Roei Yisrael, the seven shepherds of Israel, and that's Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, Moshe Aaron, Yosef, and David. And the upper three don't relate to people. So, and they are often divided. So we talk about the lower seven, and the seven, that those are the, they're related also to the 7 days of the week. Pardon? Okay, no problem. Just so you know how the conference call works, if you want, you can ask any questions anytime, but let's say there's noise in the background that you don't want, or a kid comes in the room and you need to talk to him. If you press star six, it will mute you, and then star six will unmute you. So you could answer it. You could answer a kid or somebody if something crashes and somebody's crying. You can just press star six and, you know, put it on speaker and do whatever you need to do. So just so you know. Okay, so the ten sefirot then are really a mechanism by which Hashem hides himself in the creation. So in order for Hashem, not in order, because Hashem could do whatever he wants, but the way Hashem chose to set up creation is through this system of 10 emanations, 10 sefirot, starting from him, his ideas, and then going down. So Malchut would be the realm that we live in, but there's a 9 above that. So the mashal that I use to explain them is sort of like trying to get power from a nuclear power station. So we know that if we would take our cell phone and plug it directly into the nuclear reactor, it would melt down, right? We wouldn't have a cell phone left. So in order for our cell phone to get the power that it needs, first it goes to the nuclear reactor, then it goes to a transfer station, a switching station, where that whole thing is surrounded in barbed wire because it's so dangerous to approach. And then that reduces the power further to another major switching station. Again, surrounded in barbed wire. It's barbed wire until it's practically in your backyard. Then that transfers over across wires into what you see in the countryside. Big, usually they're concrete buildings surrounded by barbed wire with tall posts and long wires across the country that take electricity to our homes, to our neighborhoods. And then from there, you'll see it goes to smaller little things within our neighborhoods somewhere. I don't know if you see it in New York. Maybe that's buried under the streets in New York. But we certainly have it in, there's a gully behind us a few blocks away, and there's those electrical switching stations. They look like, I don't know, about the size of a shed, and then it's also surrounded by barbed wire and still poles and posts, and then it goes to what's in our neighborhood. At the top of the electrical poles in our neighborhood, look right outside the house, it still has a big, about the size of, let's say, a keg of beer, right, hanging from a line. It's about that size. That still contains electricity that would kill somebody if they touched it, and unfortunately, line workers get paid a lot of money because their life is in danger working with so much electricity, people who climb those poles. But we regularly have blackouts just because squirrels run across it and trip it and they die and we're out of electricity. But then it goes from that, whatever that thing is called, to the house, to our fuse box. And from our fuse box into our outlets. And from our outlets, we plug in whatever it is we want to have power. But for our cell phone, we plug in something that further reduces the power, because if our cell phone would receive the power directly from the outlet, it also would melt. So we have something that helps reduce it further and has that thin little cord that goes into our cell phone. So all of those transfer stations reduce the energy from something so powerful, a nuclear reactor, all the way down to usable in something like a cell phone. So that's sort of the way the spherot work. It's just a muscle. That's sort of the way the spherot work. They take Hashem's energy, which is really unusable by anything in creation, and reduce it, and reduce it, and reduce it, and reduce it. And every single spherot that Hashem's koch passes through, Hashem's energy emanates through, it gets reduced further and further and further until it's more and more usable, more and more accessible by this lowest level that we live in. So so that's the realm of Malchut. It's the 10th sphera, or the 7th sphera. So we have this construct of the 10 spherot. Now let's move to an additional and parallel construct. So this spherot is one way of explaining it. I think there are other ways of explaining spherot that include more than 10, but the 10 is the basic Kabbalistic concept that we talk about, and we see very often all kinds of things that parallel those 10 spherot. And each one has its own energy and own arena in which things work. Different things happen in different spherot. They're related to different character traits. So the lower seven, for instance, the upper three are related to different types of wisdom, chachma, bina, and dat. And then the lower seven related to chesed and gevura. So those character traits of kindness, of the flow, and then gevura. Chesed would be on the right side, that's flowing energy. Gevura is on the left side. Left is the feminine side, and that's the side that delineates, that cuts off. So gevura would be on the left side, a side that cuts, and then comes tiferet, balanced in the middle. Netzach and Hod are considered twins. They're not really left and right. They just happen to be placed on left and right because they're twins, so they're compared to the kidneys. Each one of these spherot is also compared to a body part. But the Netzach and Hod are compared to the kidneys as twins. They function, those two brothers were parallel rather than one above the other. They, Moshe and Aaron, they both worked in their own realms, but they were of parallel importance. And then Yosef is back in the middle of the chart. Yosef is Yesod, and then David representing Malchut on the bottom, where everything is made manifest. Malchut is considered a feminine realm where everything is received into the lower realm of Malchut. All the other emanations pour themselves into the lowest realm of Malchut. Those seven are also parallel to the days of the week, with the sixth level, Yesod, being parallel to the letter Vav, which is six, and everything channeling through the letter Vav into the lowest level, the feminine realm, and the letter Vav representing attachment, and representing the letter and, which connects one thing to another, and also carries from one generation to the next. It represents the male energy also that transfers his genetic material from one generation to the next. So the flow of all the weekdays passes through the Vav, that connector, into the realm of the feminine, into the realm of Malchut. So that's where things are made manifest. Okay, now let's just take that and set it on one side of our minds and open up a second window, so to speak, for this four-leveled construct. Really, it's five levels, but we talk about four. So the reason why it's really four is because the first level is Hashem, and that can't be a level, of course. But if Hashem, if the reason for these worlds is to create distance between Hashem and us, distance between cause and effect, distance between Hashem's rut zone and our rut zone, then there's another way to do that, another way of understanding it. So that's this. So first comes Hashem. Next to Hashem is the world of Atzilut. Below that is Briah. Below that is Yetzirah. And below that is Asiyah. So these four worlds. Atzilut, I mean Etzel, comes from the word Etzel, which means right next to. But it also means emanation, something that emanates from. So the world of Atzilut is often compared to the rays of the sun. So if Hashem, which you can't compare to anything physical, so we won't. So if you imagine the sun, and it has rays that emanate from it, and the rays that emanate from the sun are of the energy of the sun, but even as they emanate, they don't diminish the sun in the least. So they are the sun, but they don't diminish the sun. They emanate from the sun, and they can go far out from the sun. Of course, Hashem is everywhere, so it's not that the rays... It's not that Hashem isn't somewhere, and yet Hashem contracted Hashem's self so that there could be that space between Hashem and us, Hashem and the world, Hashem and our rest zone. So the first world is absolute emanation, and it's sort of like Hashem's idea. It's not even really a world yet. The lower three are considered worlds, but this one, really, absolute, is right next to Hashem, like a thought in our brain that's not really separate from us, but is no longer completely integral either. So we've spoken it out, it's still part of us that's not separated, and yet there's something about that thought that is no longer completely inside us, because it's now separated itself into a different compartment in our brain. So that's Atzilut. The next, Atzilut is with an Aleph. So Aleph Tzadi, yeah, Aleph Tzadi. Right, so. So, and that word actually comes from Yeshayahu. That word comes from Devarim. Hang on, let me read the source because I did look it up because it's important just to see. Might as well go a little deeper here. Hang on. I'll find it. It's the Midbar, not Devarim. It's the Midbar in Perek Yedal, Pasuk Yud Zion. And the pasuk is, where does it start? V'yiradati v'dibarti imach sham v'atzalti min haruach asher alecha v'samti aleihem v'nesu, okay, da-da-da. Okay, so the concept is here, is v'atzalti. So the word comes from that, and the Art Scroll translation doesn't help. So I knew that the Arya Kaplan translation would be helpful for us, because really what we want to see is how v'atzalti is translated, and here it's translated as emanate. So the Arya Kaplan translation is, when I lower my essence and speak to you there, I will cause some of the spirit that you possess to emanate, and I will grant it to them. You will then not have to bear the responsibility all alone. So Hashem's speaking to Moshe, right? The Atzalti is, I'm going to emanate, Hashem's telling Moshe, I'll emanate some ruach upon you so that you'll have some of that Atzalti. Right, so I'm saying, v'yiradati v'dibarti imacha sham v'atzalti min haruach asher alecha. Oh, he's saying he's going to put the ruach that he's got onto the, onto those who are going to help him judge. But I didn't read the whole story around it. I should know exactly what it is. But anyway, it comes from there, v'atzalti emanate. But now the other three words come from Yeshayahu, mem gimel, Pasuk Zion, I think. Let's just look. Where did that come from? It is Pasuk Zion. Kol hanikra b'shmi v'lichvodi barati yetzartiv v'asitiv. Right, so kol hanikra b'shmi, everyone who's called in my name, v'lichvodi, and it's my honor, barativ, I created it, him, yetzartiv, I formed him, as asitiv, and I also made it. So there's those three words that are used there. So those are the two sources for where those four names come from. So bria, livro, is the kind of creation that only Hashem can do. Right? Borei pri hagafen. That's only Hashem can be borei. Nothing else is borei. Borei connotes yesh mi'ayin, or connotes a divine creation, as opposed to the next level below it, yitzira, which is forming something. We can be Yotzer. Yotzer is like a potter, right? Borei creates the earth, but Yotzer makes it into a vessel. So Bria is that second level after Atzilut. And Yetzira is the formation of it. And Asiya is actually doing. That's the lowest level here. So we live in Olam HaAsiya, in the Asiya world. And the upper three are considered where the kochot are, where the sfirot are. So according to the Ramak and Yitzhak Luria, they're the ones who introduced this concept of this fourfold understanding of how these four worlds. And according to their thoughts, the Asiya, the Atzila, is where the ten sfirot would be, or that's the area of the tensor. So now I'm just telling you stuff that I'm reading. I don't fully understand these concepts. Bria, the world of creation, is where the Kisei HaKavod is. That comes from the emanations of the light of the Sefirot. I don't understand that either. Yetzira is the world of becoming, where the Malachim are. And here it says, forming the halls for the sphere of, I don't know if that means at all, but that's where the Malachim would be in the world of Yetzirah. So we'll talk about that in a minute. And here we are in the world of Asiya, and that's where the heavens are and this material world that we live in. So all the physical worlds in the world of Asiya. Yetzirah would be the spiritual world just above that. Bria is the spiritual world above that. And Atzila is not even considered its whole own world, but is what's above that. Okay, now just to add a little bit more, before we clear it up, I just want to add one layer more of slight, not really confusion, but just an extra thought here. So the Ramchal is going to get to this later in the Sefer, but just so you know, as long as we're discussing all this right now, these four worlds are related to the four letters in the Shem Hashem. So Atzilut is the first Yud, is the Yud. Briah is the first He. Yitzirah is the Vav. And Asiyah is the final He. So we've discussed before that there's a pasuk, Kiva Katsur Olamim, that the upper worlds are created with the Yud, and the lower world is created with the He. The upper world created with that which looks like the seed of life. Contains the DNA for everything. Everything's in potential in that Yud. That's the upper world. That's the Kohot. The world of the Kohot are the potential, everything in potential. And then the He is everything in manifestation. He, the letter He, is just breath, right? The way you pronounce it is just a... If there's no vowel under it, it doesn't have a sound. Just is an exhalation. But it's the exhalation of manifestation. Hashem created this world through speech. So that exhalation became manifest in all the things that are here. Everything that we see, everything in the physical world is manifest through speech. And we also said that the word devar, word, is the same word as the word devar, thing. That things started as words and then manifested as things. Because Hashem chose to create the world through Koach HaDibur, through speech. Okay, so the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He name, excuse me, alternate between masculine and feminine, and is the perfect blend of the whole thing. So it does represent, and I'm not sure where Akiva Tats gets his construct from, but it's clearly, I mean, he articulates it well in either World Mask or Living Inspired, one of those two books, about the masculine and the feminine energy. And that's what is working here in this four-letter name of Hashem, the masculine energy, not the energy of men, that masculine energy. We all have both energies, masculine and feminine, in all of us. Just in most men, the masculine energy is dominant. And in most women, the feminine energy is dominant. But we all have both. So not speaking about men and women here, but just about the masculine and the feminine. So the Yud is the masculine energy. It's the energy of inspiration, and it's that which it would be a causative energy directing something to happen or causing something to happen. The He then receiving that inspiration, the Vav then, excuse me, I'm taking on the role, the masculine role again, transforming that initial inspiration through the hay into something that can be made more manifest, but then the final hay taking it and bringing it all the way to fruition. Did I go through these four letters with you at any time before in the shiur, just to know if I should elaborate a little bit more or not? Do you know? I'm just going to assume by your silence. Pardon? Okay, so I'm just going to, just for the sake of here, I'm just going to go through this again with my architect, Mushel. So if you're thinking about masculine and feminine, so Rabbi Akiva Tats discusses masculine and feminine. The easiest way to see this pattern of energy is male, female, and baby, father, mother, and baby. So male giving the inspiring energy, meaning that... I think I did say it in this class, but I can't remember that one cell contribution that I joked with my husband about. But so the male gives that piece of DNA. Excuse me, it's a quick gift, an easy gift to give. It's given through pleasure and received quickly. However, excuse me, after it's received, it takes a long time to make it manifest. The transformation process, which is the feminine energy of receiving and transforming, making it into something that can finally be used, is a time a time-consuming process, and that's what's happening here in the next level. And then there's transcendence after that. So when a baby is born, it's neither the masculine energy or the feminine energy. It's something that is both and transcends both. That's what a baby is. It's both together and neither one by itself. So, but here we have four instead of three. So what is that? Masculine, feminine, masculine, feminine. And then transcendence. So in if you think about a building, Ruchi, if you think about the house that you're in or the building that you're in, so an astute architect could sit in that building and from the building draw up the blueprint. Could look around the building and draw up a blueprint that would make it possible to build the identical building across the street or somewhere where there's room. So the identical building could be built. However, what the architect can't see is what's in the walls, you know, whether it's wired for Wi-Fi or what the plumbing looks like or the electricity, that's hidden. But what he could observe, he can write down. So the first energy in building a building is creating a blueprint. So the blueprint is the idea. If you conceive of the idea, what you want the building to look like, let's say you're in the building now and you're thinking what we really need, or let's switch it over to Sarah, right, in Charlotte, what you really need is a new Torah center, and you could imagine what it looks like, right? You want classrooms, you want base measures, you want a library, you want a place to daven, you want a place to play for kids, and you want bathrooms that are separate from all those areas so nobody has to hear anything, and you want a kitchen area, and you want storage area, and you could imagine, like if somebody would say, whatever you want, we'll build, you right away would have an idea of what it could look like. That's the yud, that inspiration. Then you call, you know, somebody who's funding you and says, okay, now call the architect. So the architect comes. The architect now sits across the table from Sarah and says, okay, tell me your dream. And the architect receives from her, her vision, what she wants. And she describes everything. She's still the yud, and the architect is the hey, receiving everything. The architect then goes home, draws up the blueprints. The blueprints then become the vav. So the architect's role is receiving the hay, but then creates a document that becomes the vav. So the blueprint then becomes a causative agent, directing what comes next. So it becomes a causative agent, and the next thing that happens is that a contractor is hired. The contractor looks at the blueprints, basically takes his orders from the blueprints, and then calls up whatever stores and workers, hires all the workers and calls up all the wholesale and orders all the bricks and the mortar and the tiles and the drywall and everything that's necessary to build the building. Everything is delivered, and slowly all the workers put it together so that now you have something, and now you have a building. Now you have the brand new Charlotte Torah Center, exactly as conceived by Sarah. And it's a stunning center which transcends everything. It's not Sarah's idea anymore. It came from her idea, but it's not her idea. What you're standing inside now is not the idea, and it's not the architect, and it's not the blueprint, and it's not the workers, and it's not all the raw materials. Excuse me. It's everything all together that transcends all of it. It is the Charlotte Torah Center. So the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey, name of Hashem, represents those four aspects of bringing something to completion, the giving, the receiving, the transforming. The giving, the receiving, the transforming is the masculine and the feminine perfect blend to make things work. So those four layers go with the four layers of those worlds, Atzilut, Briah, Yetzirah, and Asiyah. If you even think of the architect muscle, so Sarah's idea, when she first conceives of it, that initial thought, Charlotte Torah Center, what it could look like, right? So that's an idea that hasn't even left her head yet, but is the causative agent of the whole thing, right? And then comes Bria, then comes the ability to create Yesh Mi'ayin, so you're taking an idea and putting it on paper, but it's nothing really. You can't live on a piece of paper, you can't function on a piece of paper. But that then is transferred and made into the causative agent, the vav, where everything takes shape. the Yetzirah, where things are shaped and formed from that into Asiyah, where everything is made manifest finally, where everything's put together and transformed into something usable. That's the world of Asiyah that we live in here. Okay, so now we have these. Pardon? Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's a mashal. So what I was describing was a process as a mashal, so that we could understand a little piece of how the yud and the hey and the vav and the hey work together to be masculine and feminine as an integrated whole, because Hashem is an integrated whole. He's not masculine and he's not feminine. We use he when speaking about God. We use the masculine language because God in general, when we relate to Hashem, we, all of humanity relates in the feminine as receivers, and Hashem relates to us in general as a giver. So we use the masculine language. But Hashem, of course, is not male. But we want to try to understand something of Hashem and something of these worlds and how they might work with the construct of them. So I was using the architectural concept as a mashal. A mashal is just when you explain something that you can recognize to try to understand something that you don't recognize. So that's the purpose of it. So let's say somebody's never seen an ocean, but they haven't even seen a lake, but they've seen a bathtub, right? So you could say an ocean's like a bathtub, except for the bathtub's so big it fills your house, but it's so big it fills the block, but it's so big it fills the city. And if you would make it, you know, six cities together, that would be a big lake. But if it's even bigger, it would cover the whole continent, that would be an ocean. You start with something that we can understand to get to something that you can't understand. So on one hand, just using it as a mashal. But we certainly have that process, this energy of the masculine energy, feminine energy, and transcendence and manifestation exists all around us. That pattern is all around us. So, for instance, rain and earth and flowers, rain, Geshem, being masculine, and earth, Adama, being feminine, and flowers transcending both. So you have the rain that goes into the earth, and there's stuff in the earth, but in the end you get flowers, and that's something totally different than the rain or the raw material that's in the ground. So we have this concept of masculine, feminine, working together to create transcendence. Something that goes beyond with it is, or synergy would be another word. Sometimes it's transcendent and sometimes it's synergy. So, and that pattern exists on this level, excuse me, in Asiyah. I don't know if it exists in that four-lettered way in the other worlds as well, but for sure in this world, I mean, even if you think about creating Ezra's Nashim, right, so you have a concept, and when you go to a meeting, you discuss the concept, flesh it out with other women, and that would be the feminine part, the concept, having the concept, we're going to make our own thing. That's masculine energy right there. Conceiving of it, right, like that, is masculine. But then fleshing it out and figuring it out and making lists and who should we call, how do we do this, and how will we fundraise, and where will we house it, and figuring out all those details is the feminine energy, taking that initial idea and stretching it and pulling it and filling it out and transforming it until finally you have an ambulance that's all set up for childbirth and it's staffed with trained women and they've all been trained and they're sitting in the ambulance. It's something that's not your idea and it's not the meetings and it's not the fundraising, but it's something completely different. It's the synergy of it all, right? And you should be benched with that soon. We should be benched with that soon. But we see that, you know, throughout, even preparing for Shabbos, right? So right away you think, oh, I want something different this Shabbos. I'm tired of regular gefilte fish, right? So you think sushi, right? So now you have to look up a recipe and you have to buy the ingredients. So that's the thought, I want something different. How about sushi? Okay, that's your masculine energy. Now, when you go online to look up how to make sushi and you watch a YouTube video of how to roll it properly and then you go buy all the ingredients, that's all the feminine energy. Right? But the little rolls of sushi that hopefully they come out little and nice because they don't usually the first few times that you serve on your table, that's the synergy of the whole thing, the masculine and the feminine. So that happens throughout this world. We have that the masculine, feminine, and then synergy pattern. That happens a lot. That's its own thing. It's something to understand that that's part of the process of the world. And if we just know that that is the process, we can expect that after inspiration comes uncomfortable protraction of figuring things out. That's just par for the course. That's the way the pattern is. Have a great idea. Now take a long time to make it manifest. That's just the way it works. Come home with money. Money's great, but you can't eat it, right? So if you come home with $100, you first have to take the $100 to the store, buy ingredients, bring the ingredients home, and prepare them. Money helps you eat. That's the money in that sense is the masculine, but the taking it to the store and translating it into food is the feminine energy. So that pattern's everywhere. If you just understand that that's the way it works, so then you don't get so frustrated that you can't bite into a $100 bill. You know, you have to make it into something. So you don't get so frustrated that it's taking so long to make this project happen or so long to make this marriage work well. You know, that's the way it is. You know, you have the initial inspiration, well, it's great, we're married, so fabulous, you know, wonderful husband, we have the wedding and come home and things are terrific for the first day, and then it's like, oh my gosh, Shana Rishona starts, and it's difficult. Now they call it Tekufa Rishona, not Shana Rishona. It could be difficult for a while to try to figure things out. You have all those, you know, all those battles. Whose job is it to do that and the other thing? And how do you communicate? And what does each word mean? And how do the two of you from different families work things out? That's par for the course. If you know it, you can just, you know, breathe through it until you get to 5 or 10 years down the road when things are working much more smoothly, hopefully. I remember on my 4th anniversary, a friend who's older, called and I said, oh, today's our anniversary. She said, that's so nice. Which anniversary is it? I said, it's our 4th. She said, oh, 4? That's so cute. And I thought, cute? 4 is not cute. 4 is like really hush up. 4 is past newlywed. You're like really out of the newlywed stage. 4 is like solidly married. You're really there. It's not cute at all. It's like solid married. So, and then like the next day I was listening to a shiur where some Rebbetzin was talking about the early decades of marriage. And I thought, early decades of marriage? Like that's a totally different perspective. Early decades of marriage. But now that I've passed the early decades of marriage, I see that it is its whole own thing, those first couple of decades of marriage or first 2.5, you know, of child rearing and being busy with things. It's a very different stage than later decades of marriage. So, and hopefully, if you make it to the later decades of marriage, hopefully you've built something that is quite pleasant to live in, but really took those early decades to build. So that's that feminine energy of really taking what you envisioned initially as a kala. Marriage, wow, fabulous, you have that great idea. And then you jump into it and, oh, then comes the feminine energy of how do we make it like that idea that I had? And hopefully you do, except for the deepened idea. Okay, any more questions on this so far before we go ahead with it? Okay. So I wanted to lay that down as a concept so that we have this thought of different tiers or different levels through which Hashem's energy emanates before it gets to us, so to speak. Because that's helpful in understanding where the malachim are in the whole scheme of things, that there is a scheme of things. And that the malachim have a place in it, and that energy transfers have a place in this whole scheme of things. Okay, so that being said then, let's think again about our marionette for just a minute. When I looked up the picture that I sent along with the little description of the class last week, I remembered that I forgot a piece of my muscle, and that's the hand, right? So you have the marionette with the wooden piece on top, the strings that go below, the doll underneath, and the hand on top of that. So the hand really is the world of Atzilut. That's the causative energy. That's Hashem's emanation, right? Because the hand, you know, is attached to a person. Of course, Hashem's not a person at all. This is strictly a muscle. But the hand is what causes things to move. When the hand is moving the wooden apparatus on top, the hand is its own thing caused by the thoughts of the one who owns the hand, and then it's attached to the three layers below that. Right? So if you think of the hand as Atzilut and the owner of the hand is Hashem, then you can see that you have the world of Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya below it. So you have the Bria is the wooden stuff on top, and Yetzira would be the strings, and Asiya would be the doll itself, in terms of a mashal for those four. But in terms of us and how the energy works, right, so Hashem causes things to happen in Shemei Shemaim, in like the heaven, the higher heavens. That would be the wooden part. And then Malachim bring that energy down into our world to make it manifest. That would be the strings, where those spiritual neurotransmitters bring Hashem's ideas down to us or cause things to happen on us. So again, we said the whole world works that way with a deterministic energy. Hashem determines what should happen. The energy flows down from above and causes things to happen. It works that way for everything. And for human beings, it has an additional way of working, which is that we can send energy back up those strings. So when we move, when we do something, when we think, today in my Sefer Chinuch class, we're talking about not bearing grudges and not taking revenge. So a grudge, of course, is just in your heart. Right? It's not an action that you take, but it's an iser nonetheless. So even just having a thought of you want to bear a grudge against somebody, so that thought sends, once it's been concretized into the avera, once you've brought it to the place that it crosses the line and it's now an avera, that avera then does travel up those energy lines and affect what's happening in Shemaim and shift the energy as it then flows back down because everything is connected that way. So mitzvot, averot, they create different energy emanations from us. It emanates back up. So that's really what number four is saying, is that the energy emanates from above and comes down to affect everything below, and that's the way it works for everything except for mankind, which can send energy back up. So man is made completely independent, in that man is not, there's no determination if man will be good or evil, or if he'll do good or do evil. That's not determined. That's up to us to choose. Okay, so turning the page for me anyway. See, man is thus given the power to influence the world and its creatures in any manner his free will desires. The world, therefore, contains two opposite general influences. The first is natural determinism, while the second is indeterministic. The deterministic influence is directed downward from on high, while the indeterministic is directed upward from below. This is because the deterministic is the influence that stems from the highest forces, and therefore when it is directed toward our material world, it is directed downward. The indeterministic influence, on the other hand, is the result of man's free will here in the physical world. Since both man and his actions are physical, the only direct influence that he can have is on physical things. So that's what kind of a crossways influence. Because of the linkage, though, between the physical world and the highest forces, however, every time a physical thing is influenced, it also has an effect on its counterpart among these forces. Since man's deeds in the world below are what influences these forces on high, man's influence is said to be directed upward. It is thus the exact opposite of the natural deterministic influences. So again, that's like we talked about that triangle, I think, in this class, or we read Aryeh Kaplan's words that discussed how two things in the spiritual world are considered close if they resemble each other, but only by resemblance. They can't be moved closer if they don't resemble each other, unlike the case in the physical world, where two opposites can be made through force to be next to each other. So that it, in the physical world, opposites can be pushed closer together. In the spiritual world, they cannot. Excuse me. So since we have distance between us and Hashem, if we want to bring us closer, we can't, in the spiritual world, push ourselves closer or our neshamas closer to Hashem. But by using the physical world, we can. So that's part of what this is explaining. So before we discussed how if a mitzvah is Hashem's desire for us, then it is, there's something about that mitzvah, something about that physical thing that he commands us to do or to refrain from that is of Hashem because it's Hashem's desire. So there's something about Hashem that's in that mitzvah. When we participate in that mitzvah, we engage in something that is of Hashem. So Hashem emanates its ratzon into the physical world by creating a mitzvah. We then engage in that mitzvah, and then we're able to, through the mitzvah, through the physicality of the mitzvah, touch Hashem, so to speak, through that. So the physical world is what allows us to do that. But so, too, in the physical world, we can touch other forces or create forces that go back up. So it is by influencing the physical world that we can thereby influence the spiritual world because they are connected. Okay, let's see. It is necessary to know, however, that even man's deeds... I'm not even keeping track of the time. Okay, I'm paying attention here. Even man's deeds are not all the result of his free will. While this is true of most of his actions, there are some that result from divine decrees to reward or punish him, as will be discussed in detail in a later section. Such decrees take place in the same manner as other natural phenomena, where the influence is directed downward from the highest forces. Nevertheless, even in such cases, the elements resulting from the individual's own free will are still directed upward in the manner discussed earlier. This is just adding that while we do have free will and we can choose what we do, there are some times when we are subject to deterministic forces where Hashem causes us to do something for whatever reason, whether for ourselves or for somebody else or as an agent for somebody else. And then that doesn't, when we do that thing that we're caused to do, that doesn't send energy back up. It's just a product of our free will that sends energy back up. Okay. I just want to read five, so we've made this very short, just so it won't be one paragraph per class. Okay. God arranged things. Pardon? Sorry. Okay, God arranged things so that every matter falling within the realm of man's free will should be able to affect the transcendental forces through this indeterministic influence according to the measure and degree set forth by God. This is not true only of man's deeds, but even of his speech and thoughts. The amount and degree of this influence, however, cannot exceed the limits decreed and circumscribed by the highest wisdom. So this paragraph is just coming to say that, yes, we do have the ability to affect the physical world. The physical world is connected to the spiritual world, so through being physical, we can affect the spiritual. But it's not just what looks physical to us, an actual movement, but also our speech and also our thoughts. A proof of that being, or a pointer to that being, even the thought of holding a grudge or the thought of a Ahavas Yisrael, is a mitzvah or an aveira. Even our thoughts, and certainly our speech, and for sure our deeds, all three of those realms can affect the spiritual world, because they all do happen here in the physical world. So they do affect that. But only to the degree that Hashem allows that influence to happen. So we could say, always easiest to use the far end of the spectrum. So if you want to say 9/11, right? So the pilots flew into those buildings. Hashem, that was below the limit that Hashem allows, because obviously it happened. So Hashem allows that to happen. So Hashem does allow for quite a bit, but he does have a cap on certain influences, what can happen and what can't happen. So only certain things, we can only go to a certain place because of the concept of Hashgacha Klali, of the Hashgacha of the whole world, that there is a stream of history that's going to happen. We get to choose our role within that stream. We can choose how, in a way, how we get to the destination that Hashem is leading us toward. But we don't get to pick the destination. We can sometimes speed it up or slow it down, and we can take our own meanderings along the way. But in general, the flow of history is headed to a specific destination, and that's not something that we can change. That's something that Hashem promised. In the end, we're getting there, but which we'll go into more later. But meanwhile, along the way, we get to make a lot of choices, but never a choice that will take us out of that stream, out of the ultimate flow of where we're headed. So, for instance, we do have free will, but we clearly see, for instance, Paro's heart being hardened. Okay, so that's a problem within the free will concept. Did he have free will? Two ways of dealing with Paro's heart being hardened, or two of the ways is one, in order for the stream of history to be flowing correctly, Hashem actually had to suspend Paro's free will to make things work the way he wanted it to work. So he took it away from that one person so that things would work the way he wanted. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that in the face of such tremendous revealed miracles, one doesn't really have free will. You're blinded by the brilliance of what happened. You have to do what Hashem wants, so that in order to restore Paro's free will, Hashem hardened his heart, so that he would have the ability to go against Hashem if he wanted to. That's with Paro. Let's just talk Obama for a minute, right? So we do have a concept that every single human being has free will, except heads of state don't have 100% free will, because they affect the world. So while Obama gets to choose if he yells at his wife or not, or whether he eats nutritiously or not, or whether he tucks his daughters into bed with a kind word or not, that's totally within the realm of his free will. Whether he declares war on Iraq or sends a nuclear bomb somewhere, chas v'shalom, that is not his free will. That's in the realm of Hashem. It's just too much for one person to be able to decide that on their own. It affects the whole stream of history. So it's helpful as a Jew in scary times to be able to trust the fact that Hashem runs the greater plan. Certainly, Hashem runs every part of the plan, but the world's not going to disappear without Hashem allowing it to happen, and Hashem has promised that's not going to happen right now, and for sure that the Jewish people won't. So you don't have to worry about that in terms of being a nation. Each individual person, however, is a different story. So I guess we'll end there. I want to end on a positive note. Let's see. Flip it around and make it positive. It's Tu B'Shvat tomorrow night. So one of the aspects of Tu B'Shvat is to daven, if the sap is rising in the trees, it's a chag of emuna, because you can't see the life in the tree, but you trust, you have emuna, you know it's true, that the sap is beginning to rise and it's going to come to life. That's the beginning of life. Before you can see anything, there's no buds or blossoms or anything. It's really still the winter. We have quite a bit of snow on the ground here in Denver right now. But Tu B'Shvat is when you know it's the very beginning. In Eretz Yisrael, the sap begins to rise in the trees, and that's when we have a minhag then to daven for a good esrog, because we know that the sap rising is the beginning of the fruition that manifests in that esrog. But not just that, the esrog, when you take those four species together, each one of the four species, the arvanim, represents a different body part, with the lulav being the spine, and the aravos being the lips, and the hadassim being the eyes, and the esrog is the, you guys know, right? The heart. So when we're davening for a good esrog, we're also davening for a good heart, that our emuna should be intact, that we should be strong, that our sap should rise, even in times of trial and difficulty, even in the winter. that we should have a strong life force deep inside us that wells up and helps create a strong heart. So with that, I'll say happy Tu B'Shvat to everybody a day early, and Mirat Hashem, next week we'll continue. And if you have any questions, sure, pleasure. I guess I didn't leave time really for questions and discussion, but if you have any, I'm happy to wait for a minute. Well, for sure, we have a concept of that tefillah, tshuva, and tzedakah, ma'avirim, adroha, ha'gzeira, right? So why? Because it transforms the person. So if there's a gzeira, that something's supposed to happen to somebody, gzeira usually being negative, right? So somebody is supposed to get cancer, right? But that person now does tefillah, tshuva, tzedakah, or any one of the three, or a lot of one, or all three, whatever it is, any combination. But through doing that, they transform themselves. Then they are no longer the address to which that gzeira was sent. That gzeira was addressed to who they were before they did that. So they no longer exist. The address of that gzeira no longer exists. And so it can't be delivered because the person is a different person. So you can take yourself out of it by that. Now, that's only if it's because it's a gezeira. So it's important to understand. Let's just use cancer as a mashal, you know, or serious illness as a mashal. So there are people who are supposed to get some kind of illness. Sometimes it's because they need to correct their ways. So it's a patch to push them back on the path. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's, let's say, the rest of the family needs to improve in their chesed, and that person's going to be the catalyst for the whole family. So then it doesn't have to do necessarily with a tikkun of that person. So that person wouldn't necessarily be able to shift their being sick by tefillah, tshuva, and tzedakah, because it's not necessarily a gezeira, but rather it's a catalyst. So we don't always know why things happen. We still want to respond within the realm of what's happening to the best of our ability. But so we can sometimes choose ourselves out of determined things, but that's only on a small level, you know, like something determined like sickness. But something determined, let's say, like war, that's on a greater level. It's possible that individual actions can't shift that. It's also possible that national actions can, like, for instance, in the Gilas Esther, right? So national actions did change the gezeira for the nation. So individual actions could change the gezeira for an individual and national for a nation, but sometimes individuals aren't always successful in changing it for on a national scale. That happens to be one of the reasons for Kiruv. You know, one, if we understand this, that we need to work together as a people, that one person on their own isn't enough. That's why we're not called the B'nai Avraham, even though he had the idea. We're called the B'nai Yisrael, because that's the nation, right? That we have to work together. And work together means all of us. We all have to pull together. So we have to let our brethren know that everybody has to get on the bandwagon. We're one nation. We have to work together. So, okay, great. Okay, sure. Okay, good. Well, okay, call to bye-bye.